For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As Saudis picked through the rubble in Riyadh yesterday, the White House sent messages of support to the kingdom just days after President Bush urged democratic reform in the Middle East. Rooting out terrorists is the top Saudi priority. 6 months after another suicide bombing destroyed three luxury housing complexes in the Saudi capital, some fear that Osama bin Laden's wish to bring down the House of Saud could become a reality. Tonight on Point, rocking the House of Saud, terror inside Saudi Arabia. We begin with the latest news from Saudi Arabia. Khalid Al-Mayna is editor of the Arab News, an English-language daily newspaper published in Jeddah. I asked him how the Saudi government is responding to yesterday's bombings.
I think it's viewed as a terrorist act by the authorities. It's viewed with revulsion and horror by the public. And I think while it has the hallmarks of an Al-Qaeda attack, we are waiting to see what the authorities will say in the next few days.
And what's the unofficial response to this? When Saudis get together privately and talk about what happened, how are people interpreting this?
It's an act against society. I mean, it's an act against Saudi Arabia itself. We are really revolted because it has happened during the time of Ramadan, which is a month of fasting and worship. The attack was directed against people who were innocent. Five young children died. Others were injured. I mean, these people have no respect for life. And that's the way it's viewed at.
And what about the motivation for the attack? How are people that you're speaking with interpreting that?
Well, if these people have grievances, the general feeling, I was in Riyadh the day before the attack, and I came and I sat with a large group of people last night, because in Ramadan we have late hours, and people were sitting and discussing this. They view it as a terrorist act. There's no motivation. Why would you do that? If you have grievances, as somebody said, there are other ways to sort of talk about it or to act, but you don't go blowing people, innocent people who are going to sleep.
But terrorist acts usually have goals. What's the goal of this attack? Is it to bring down the royal family, the House of Saud?
No, the House of Saud is not a house of cards. I mean, these people can go on from now till kingdom come. I think the goal of these people is to instill terror and fear. Also, remember, there are great changes happening in Saudi Arabia. Reforms are happening. There are people who want reforms. There are people who would like the wheel of progress to go ahead. Now, if these people want a Taliban type of government, they're sadly mistaken, because the overwhelming majority of the Saudis are all for progress. Young people here would like to deal with a PC rather than have a grenade in their hand or do things like that.
But Khalid Al-Mayna, we hear something quite different very often. We hear about mosques where religious leaders are delivering fiery sermons against the existing order there, against the West, against non-Muslims. There seems to be a lot of anger, at least as reported, in deep-seated religious circles in Saudi Arabia.
True, there are people who are obscurantists, there are people who are misguided, and there are people who are intolerant. But at the same time, we, the silent majority, have now come up and our voice is being heard. For a long time, we allowed these people to prey upon the minds of our young people, and these people were able to brainwash a segment of the youth. But I think parents are now being very careful of where the children go, with whom they associate, what they learn, whom they hear. So I think we are arresting the development of such type of behavior among the youth. And I think that is the first step in winning the war against terror.
Khalid Al-Mayna, since the first big attack this spring in this latest round on May 12th, what steps has the government taken to try and crack down on potential terrorists?
Well, as a preventive measure, they have beefed up security. As a proactive measure, they sort of arrested 600 of these of the militants. They detained people. They questioned people. They're very careful. Their ID checks. They sort of investigated into the May 12th by really looking into that cell, breaking up a few cells, attacking some of them in their hideouts. In fact, a couple of days ago, some of these people were killed.
And what about the American influence here, President Bush calling just last week for democratic political reform in Saudi Arabia? Does that factor into this at all? Is it seen as consequential there? Does it push for reform and new stability, or does it lead to instability?
Well, we are not a banana republic. We are a sovereign nation. I mean, any advice given by friends is always welcome. But I think, you see, it's what the people aspire and what they want. Remember, this is a country where over 50% of the population is under 21. I think society has to look up and find out what are their needs and aspirations. And if we really want to go ahead and have reforms, I think what we have to do is really look into the societal expectations. Once those expectations are met, I think then, you know, we are on the road to reforms.
In the meantime, is there palpable fear there of further terrorist attacks?
I'm an optimist by nature. I don't know, but I don't think so in the sense, I mean, the road to Mecca this afternoon was clogged with cars. I think there must have been about 10,000 cars on the way to Mecca. All flights from Europe to here are full with pilgrims and Muslims coming in. Business people are streaming in from the Far East. So hopefully there will be none. But the government has beefed up security. You can see now armed guards. You can see patrols. You can see IDs being checked up. So it's, you know, it's more prominent now.
Khaled Al-Mayna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Khaled Al-Mayna is editor-in-chief of the Arab News. He spoke with me earlier today from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. There were weeks of warnings of an imminent attack somewhere in Saudi Arabia. The U.S. embassy and consulates were closed and locked down indefinitely. Then on Sunday, in Riyadh, a car packed with explosives killed at least 18 people and wounded scores more. Al-Qaeda is being blamed, though the group has not taken responsibility for the attack. Tonight on Point, terror in Saudi Arabia. What is the message in the debris in Riyadh? Does this terror attack mean it's time to speed up the push for democracy in Saudi Arabia? Or to lay off? Can the House of Saud withstand the pressures of democratization and Al-Qaeda? Where is all this headed? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Thomas Lipman, writer and journalist specializing in Middle Eastern affairs and author of the forthcoming book, Inside the Mirage, America's Fragile Partnership with Saudi Arabia. Good evening and welcome, Thomas Lipman.
Good evening. My pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage in Saudi Arabia just over the weekend said, "It is quite clear to me that Al-Qaeda wants to take down the royal family and the government of Saudi Arabia." Do you share that analysis, Thomas Lipman?
Well, I do, in the sense that the House of Saud, the ruling family in Saudi Arabia, has been the principal target, the ultimate objective of Osama bin Laden and his team since the military intervention in the United States against Iraq in 1990 and 1991.
So what's going on with these attacks in May, now again in November? What exactly, who do you think is doing it, and what's the immediate goal?
Well, you know, this is really extremely confusing because the target doesn't provide any clear-cut answers to the very legitimate questions that you're asking.
Can you describe it for us and distinguish it from the earlier targets there?
Well, yes. I think last time, in the May bombings in Riyadh seemed to be clearly aimed at Americans and at the American relationship with Saudi Arabia and at American influence or Western influence in Saudi Arabia. This time you had...
Because if I may, Thomas Lipman, those earlier residential compounds were super deluxe, largely inhabited by foreign residents.
That's correct. Now, the current compound was some years ago occupied mostly by people who worked for Boeing.
Mm-hmm.
But now, as I understand it, the occupants were mostly working class Arabs, most of them non-Saudis, some Saudis, but many not. And so what's the point of killing them if they kill Egyptians or Yemenis or Jordanians? What is the message that you're trying to send? It's really very difficult to sort out. I do know there's one school of thought that says that the reason these attacks are happening is that the extreme militant terrorist tactic jihadi people in Saudi Arabia are not getting anywhere in reaching the people of Saudi Arabia through the pulpit, through the mosque, and so they're turning to what amount to desperate tactics. That's an optimistic way of looking at it.
That's what Saudi Arabia's ambassador to Britain, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, said over the weekend. He said the attack is a sign of desperation.
and not the sign of someone who's going to succeed in upsetting the social balance or the political structure of the country, echoing President Bush's words about the resistance in Iraq right there, though I don't know if that parallel is significant at all. But do you buy that? Does this look like desperation, or does this look like a rising tide of trouble in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think Khaled Al-Bayyina, your previous interview, was quite correct in saying that this type of thing is entirely alien to the vast majority of the population in Saudi Arabia. Look, I was in Iran during the height of the Iranian Revolution, and I was when the country was in ferment. The entire population was seething with anger and rising against the Shah. I was in Lebanon during the early years of the Civil War, when it seemed as if every young man in the country had taken up arms and joined some armed faction. You simply don't have that in Saudi Arabia.
Give us a reality check then, because we're always reading in the press about fiery mullahs there, you know, putting out a stream of Wahhabist condemnation of the West, Western influences, the Western influence on the Saudi royal family. We have the sense of this as a boiling cauldron where kids are brought up with very fundamentalist extremist views of the world. Is that wrong?
This is one of those cases where the facts and the truth are not the same thing.
Help us with that.
Right. Everything that you said is, in a sense, true. And if you go back to 1979, the year the Saudi government, the royal family, was profoundly shocked by an extremist takeover of the great mosque in Mecca.
During the same time of year, wasn't it? During Ramadan? Or was
yes, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And after that, they made a kind of Faustian bargain with some of the most retrograde elements in Saudi society, the religious reactionaries, the anti-Western pulpit thumpers. They did. And they allowed them to have much stronger influence over social behavior, the norms of social behavior, over the schools, over the educational system, over what Saudis said in missions overseas, and so on. I think you could even say that the rulers of Saudi Arabia were complacent or negligent, almost to the point of criminality, about what happened as a result of turning those people loose. Now I think they're not being turned loose anymore. Now you're trying to put that genie back in the bottle.
But again, the understanding that we get over many months here is that won't go back in a bottle, that bargain, that Faustian bargain you described is still in play here, that without it, the Saudi royal family risks instability. Can you give us a sense of the crackdown that's gone on in recent months? Is it really just aimed at terrorists, or is it also going into the Wahhabi community, the purveyors of hate there?
Upward of 1,000 of the most extreme rabble-rousing preachers were removed from their positions in the mosques earlier this year. And while the Minister of Religious Affairs said that wasn't about terrorism and extremism, it was an administrative matter having to do with the budget, everybody understood that that was for domestic consumption. The fact was that they shut these people up. And that was just a sign of the way in which the government appears at long last to recognize the scope of the threat and begin to take action.
So your sense then is that this is, as you say, as the Saudi ambassador to Britain says, a sign of desperation on their part. Even though we read that foreigners all across Saudi Arabia now live in compounds that look like army installations from the exterior. The U.S. embassy and all the consulates are shut down indefinitely. That sounds like a perceived significant threat.
Well, it does. And I haven't been there in some months now. I haven't been there since before the May bombings. Mm-hmm. But I have to say that when I was before that, it was pretty much life as usual in Saudi Arabia, and even in the diplomatic quarter, security was pretty casual. I went to the residence of a very important Western diplomat in the diplomatic quarter. I hailed a cab on the street, and it rode right up to the door.
Of course, we had life as usual until September 10th here.
That's correct. That's correct. And a lot of things are happening now. There's no doubt that there's a certain kind of ferment and anxiety in Saudi Arabia, compounded by the fact that the interior minister, Prince Nayef, has been on the job, in my opinion, too long, and I'm not certain of the extent to which Prince Nayef is fully capable of coming to grips with the threat that they now face.
Thomas Lippman, stand by. We're going to come back and look at the durability of this ruling family in Saudi Arabia, the whole situation there, how it affects the United States in the region and here at home. I'm joined by Thomas Lipman, author of the forthcoming Inside the Mirage. We're talking tonight about terror in Saudi Arabia and its implications for the House of Saud and the U.S. What's the message in the debris in Riyadh? We're at 1-800-422-4000. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about terror in Saudi Arabia and its implications for the House of Saud and the United States. You can join the conversation tonight. What is the message in the debris of this weekend's suicide bombing? Can the House of Saud survive the pressures of democratization and al-Qaeda? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Thomas Lipman from Washington. He's a writer and journalist specializing in the Middle East. We're joined now from New Haven, Connecticut by Khalid Abu El Fadl. He's law professor at Yale University. Good evening and welcome, Professor Abu El Fadl.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. What's your interpretation of the blast over the weekend in Riyadh?
Well, it is a definite, there is a certain degree of desperation on part of Al-Qaeda. The Al-Qaeda, the main point is to make the Saudi government appear impotent, appear weak, appear unable to protect its citizens. Additionally, the Saudi government before the attack had made several pronouncements indicating that they have managed to quash and destroy the Qaeda in Saudi Arabia. And in my view, what this attack was designed to do was to basically snub the nose of the Saudi government to say, far from it, you haven't been able to destroy us, we're still here, and we still can cause damage.
This was the softest of soft targets, not the top tier even of residential facilities, let alone a government facility or an embassy or foreign installation, which may indicate the kind of desperation you're talking about. On the other hand, you write today in the Wall Street Journal, Khalid Abu El Fadl, that al-Qaeda is a real threat, not only to the Saudi Arabia, but to the United States. So what is it? Is this desperation or a real threat?
I don't think that we should exaggerate the desperation of Al-Qaeda. I think that what we're confronting is not just the violence that a particular organization poses. I think that what took place is, as your earlier speaker pointed out, Saudi Arabia nursed a monster. And this monster, in many predictable ways, has turned against its master, against the one that nurtured it and allowed it to become what it is. And it is pretty impossible at this point to put the monster under restraints, lock it up, unless Saudi Arabia is willing to reverse its very ideological and theological basis, unless it's willing to abandon the theology of Wahhabism in total.
So two questions then. A, can Saudi Arabia conceivably do that? And in any case, is this ruling family, this ruling monarchy, at risk of being toppled?
I think the part of the problem is that the Saudi government itself it doesn't know what the real power of Al-Qaeda and organizations like Al-Qaeda. And I want to emphasize this because Saudi Arabia is not just worried about Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. It's worried about neo-Wahhabi organizations that have infiltrated the army, have infiltrated the police, have managed to establish themselves in various parts of society. And for them to basically go back and not undertake cosmetic changes with Wahhabism, because cosmetic changes are not going to do anything. But for them to come back and say, listen, all that theology we've been teaching throughout the 20th century, we've discovered now was completely erroneous and without foundation. It's a politically, extremely politically risky, but it might be that they would have to go. They would have to go down that road. It might be that there's no other option.
Thomas Lippman, does the Saudi royal family have that kind of flexibility? You were in particular pointing out Prince Nayef, the interior minister, as being incapable.
I don't think they have that kind of flexibility because, in fact, the purpose, the raison d'être of the Saudi state and of the House of Saud is to perpetuate Islam as interpreted in the Arabian Peninsula by the school of Islam that they have followed now for 200 years. And so I don't see how you can't separate the two. The most surprising thing to me about all of this, going back to the mosque takeover, is that, and the thing that surprises the House of Saud, is in effect to find themselves attacked from the right, so to speak, rather than from the left.
Despite all their efforts to bolster that side, to build that up.
That's correct. If you read the basic law of the kingdom, which was promulgated by King Fahd in the year after Desert Storm, it's a totally Islamic document. The purpose of the state, the purpose of education is to propagate Islam. It couldn't be more Islamic.
It couldn't, which raises the interesting question of whether it's possible to straddle here, to have some relationship with the West that's open and friendly, and at the same time satisfy these most extremist elements. Thomas Lippman, Khalid Abu al-Fadl, stand by. I want to invite our callers in tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Does the destruction of Riyadh make you more sympathetic towards Saudi Arabia? Or are the Saudis reaping what they've sown, what America tasted on 9/11? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. Muhammad's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Muhammad. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, Tom. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Very well, thank you. I really want to make sure that one point is not really missed.
Make it.
And I will actually make it right now, is that Saudi Arabia is a dictatorship, and we must not forget this. And the hardcore issue here with terrorism is the lack of democracy and political freedoms, economic freedoms. And what you have here is a fat cat rulers that have squashed billions and billions of dollars from the money of the people of the Arabian Peninsula, from Morocco to Iraq to Saudi Arabia, as far as Malaysia, is the same thing. While the most majority of the people are being marginalized, while the most majority of the people are being oppressed.
Muhammad, let me ask you then. President Bush said last Thursday it's time for Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern countries to step up and become much more democratic. Do you see that as a real option for Saudi Arabia?
I really do not. And I think, you know, even if it's coming from him, I don't think it's authentic, because his action has proved otherwise for the past and in the future. And he's not really in a position to talk about democracy in the world. I really want you to understand something. When a person is sick and you go to a doctor, the doctor diagnoses you and see what's really wrong with you, and then describes you a drug so you can get cured. The problem here and the issue in the Arab world, and trust me, Tom, trust me, 99.99% of the people of the Arab world and the Islamic world want democracy and want freedom. Trust me, it has nothing to do. It has nothing to do whatsoever with religion. But the problem right now is that these people have seen in the past, since the wave of independence in North Africa and the Middle East in late 50s, that Western Europe and America have backed these regimes, these brutal dictatorships.
Well, there's no question about that. Muhammad, we've got it. And thank you for your call, Khalid Abu al-Fadl. How about it? President Bush is saying now it's time for democracy here. How does that ring to the ears of the Saudi royal family, to Saudi people more broadly?
I actually think your caller, Muhammad, has a valid point here. Number one, I don't think there is a sufficient realization, the extent to which around the world, including the Arab world, the current administration is seen to have betrayed standards of human rights and democracy. Things like our policy in Guantanamo Bay and so on have really put a dent in our credibility. Second is the Saudi government for years now has been accustomed to having several layers of speech. They have one way in which they speak to their American friends, an entirely different way in which they speak to their own people. Instead of taking calls for democracy as calls for principle, they basically react to them by thinking that they can negotiate with the American friends a little bit of reform here, a little bit of adjustment there, while the basic premise of the way they deal with their people doesn't change. I don't think the calls for democracy are going to have, by President Bush, are going to have much of an impact with the Saudi government, and I don't think they're going to have much of an impact with the Arab people, not because the Arab people do not want democracy. I actually agree with the caller that the demand for democracy is enormous. But because we have undermined quite a bit of our credibility in pushing human rights and democracy in certain ways.
Got it. Thomas Lipman, how about it then? What's the path out of this standoff between the Islamic extremists and the royal family if the U.S. can't be an effective cheerleader for democracy, though they're doing a lot more than cheerleading next door in Iraq right now? Can anybody push it, or is that not an open path? I mean, there are steps that have been taken. What, just last month, the Saudi government announced elections for municipal offices. It's a very small step, but that's coming up next year. The Crown Prince has said that the consultative assembly there, all appointed by him, but that its deliberations will be televised. Do we see some small opening democracy? Could that bleed off the tension here or not?
Well, you know, defenders of Saudi Arabia, people who endorse or have interest in the Saudi system, will always tell you that it's essentially irrelevant to talk in that context about Western-style democracy as if you were going to have a Canadian system with opposing parties and a parliament, the prime minister coming out of the winning party. They say that Saudi Arabia has its own form of public participation in which anyone can go to the majlis or the weekly meeting of any of the princes and state his case, and that the princes are simply, what you might call first among equals. I don't necessarily believe that.
We certainly don't hear anybody buying that tonight.
Well, but what we don't know, and what we really, I think, can't know from this distance, is the extent to which the majority of the people in Saudi Arabia are restive or in a rebellious mood or ready for radical change. The hallmark of Saudi society is incremental snail's pace change, socially, politically, every way except technologically.
Except we've got big forces moving here. You've got Al-Qaeda in the mix, which in the United States and around the world has shown that it's perfectly ready to push dramatic steps. You've got the United States taking dramatic steps in Iraq and with calls for a kind of reshaping of the entire region. Thomas Lipman, Khalid Abul Fadl, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Daniel Benjamin. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror. Good evening and welcome, Daniel Benjamin.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So what do you see in these attacks? Are these pinpricks or is there an insurrection underway here?
Well, I think that the attacks are symptoms of a broad-based discontent in the kingdom and are in that regard not to be taken lightly. I think there is a very large group of dissatisfied people, and within that large group there are some who either belong directly to Al-Qaeda or who espouse the same agenda or who are hangers-on. And my sense is that the people who carried this out were not in the inner circle at all and didn't have Al-Qaeda-type skills, but wanted to show that their group was still active and therefore acted, even though their surveillance was quite poor. I think this was actually a relatively screwed up attack. I don't think they ever would have done it if they'd known there were no Americans there.
Well, maybe screwed up. On the other hand, it wasn't all that unsophisticated. They got into the heart of the housing compound. They killed almost 20 people, wounded scores more in a car painted in army colors. I mean, and they've got the whole country on its ear.
Well, certainly they caused a lot of casualties and managed to gain entrance. But I think that the surveillance of Al-Qaeda historically, the tradecraft has generally been of a much higher level than what we saw there. And I think that even Al-Qaeda, which was pathbreaking in its willingness to kill Muslims, with the goal of, in the bargain of killing Americans, would not want to act this way. And in fact, some of the things I've seen today suggest that some of the jihadist websites were disavowing this one and were not pleased with the outcome.
It's interesting. The Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage has been saying in Saudi Arabia the opposite. He said, "My view is these are Al Qaeda terrorists. I believe it was Al Qaeda."
Well, it's very difficult when you're in Saudi Arabia to distinguish between those people who loathe Al Qaeda. I'm sorry, those people who like Al-Qaeda and those people who are Al-Qaeda. And in the sense that this may have been given the green light by someone at Al-Qaeda who said, yeah, do whatever you can, keep the pressure on, and the actual activity was carried out by people who had never really trained perhaps in Afghanistan in the camps or had anything to do with any other Al-Qaeda operation. The lines are blurred, and I think that one thing that we are seeing in a number of different areas is that the Al-Qaeda vision, the Al-Qaeda agenda is catching on. The idea of hitting the United States, hitting Western targets, is catching on with radical Islamist groups that have historically not had ties with Al-Qaeda and don't have its capabilities. And this could be a case in point. Whether Secretary Armitage meant this was Al-Qaeda in the sense that it was an integral part of the organization or that it was a group that operators who espouse the same ideology, I don't know.
Daniel Benjamin, we just have a minute before the break. Do you think the House of Saud is shaky, or has it still got strength despite these kind of bites at its heels?
Well, I think the royal family has a number more years that it can go on the way it has gone on. It has considerable resources for dealing with dissent, for buying off opponents, and it has, of course, great tools to deal with in terms of repression. Over the long term, they're not playing a winning hand.
Daniel Benjamin, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Daniel Benjamin, co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror. We're talking tonight about terror in Saudi Arabia and its implications for the House of Saud and for the United States. You can join the conversation. Do you think President Bush really wants democracy in Saudi Arabia, even if it meant the fall of the House of Saud? Does this look like bin Laden's handiwork to you? What do you think bin Laden and Al-Qaeda want in Saudi Arabia? Is your home safer than those homes in Riyadh? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about terror in Saudi Arabia over the weekend and its implications for the House of Saud and the United States. You can join the conversation. Does this attack mean it's time to push harder for democracy in Saudi Arabia or to lay off? And can the House of Saud survive the pressures of democratization and Al-Qaeda? We're at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight are Khaled Abu El Fadl, joining us from New Haven, Connecticut. He's a law professor at Yale University, board member of Human Rights Watch. And from Washington, D.C., Thomas Lipman, author of the forthcoming Inside the Mirage, America's Fragile Partnership with Saudi Arabia. We're joined right now from Madison, Wisconsin, by Habu. Good evening and welcome, Habu.
Yes, good evening, and thank you very much. Let me just say this about you, Mr. Ashbrook. You're one of the few national correspondents who asks tough questions. And I'm sure your next guest will be very happy to talk to you.
just doing our job, Abu. What's on your mind tonight?
Well, I see this, if I may go by way of Iraq, What has happened in Iraq is I think we are going to be in a quagmire, and I know that's overused, but a quagmire in this sense. If we continue to stay there, we're going to be taking the losses. If we leave, and this is the big one, there's going to be such a type of implosion in that area with all these jihadis stationed there and in the surrounding areas. They are going to be exporting this type of terrorism, one can call it that.
I don't know what else you call it. Habu, fill out that picture, though. Do you see a connection between what happened in Riyadh and what's going on in Iraq now?
Well, I don't know about what happened, but I know in the future they are going to target the countries that were sympathetic to the United States in its role in Iraq, like the Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Jordan. And you're going to see more of these, and more ominously, you're going to see the price of oil go up and the world go into a recession. This is something the United States cannot deal with, and so that is why it is stuck in there while the House of Saud is going to feel the reverberations of these attacks.
Abu, hang on for a moment. I want to put this to Khalid Abu El Fadl, but I want to get your response. Washington has said, the conservative elements there, Paul Wolfowitz, it's time to kind of turn over the checkerboard in the Middle East, to shake everything up and come out with a more democratic region. And it sounds like a great idea. There's a lot being put into that commitment right now. But, of course, that instability also creates opportunities for people with very different views of the future of that region. You hear what our caller's saying from Madison. This could put radicals in the driver's seat.
Well, that's part of the problem, is that we seem to approach this issue of the Middle East essentially within the mind frame of let's shake it up. Somehow we're going to get democratic values. We're going to get humanitarian values. We're going to get something that we like and we can live with. And we ignore certain elements such as the effects of Western intervention in the region, the growth of anti-Americanism or anti-Westernism, and so on and so forth. I think that in order to establish democracy in the region, there is no way around withdrawing support from extremely despotic and authoritarian governments with abysmal human rights records, mm-hmm. like the Saudi government, and there is no way around empowering civil society activists that have been screaming for democratic reforms and for human rights for the past two or three decades.
So is that what you see the Bush administration doing or not?
No, I actually see the Bush administration not doing that. I see the Bush administration being rather confused about how to go about establishing democracy. On the one hand, they make these general calls for democracy, but on the other hand, they want to continue working with governments like the Saudi government and the Egyptian government and the Jordanian government and the Moroccan government. They don't want to even upset these governments. On the third hand, they are suspicious of civil rights and civil society organizations that are critical of the track record of the conservative government of the United States. So we tend to keep a safe distance from them.
Habu, let me go back to you in Madison. What's your sense since the American intervention in Iraq? It's hard to calculate, but who has made more ground here? I mean, democracy is there's an attempt to push it ahead. At the same time, there's some attempt to take advantage of that, to turn Iraq into the jihad center of the world. Who's made more progress in your mind?
Well, you know, democracy is not just voting. I mean, I always look at the national media, BBC included. They always talk about this country and that country having elections. as Fareed Zakaria in his book has written, democracy means the whole institutions that safeguard the rights of others, the force of law, etc., etc. And we've got this very veneer type of notion of democracy, which just involves the ballot box. And quite honestly, I don't know that Washington can handle it if it were just the votes, which would come resoundingly against U.S. policy in the Middle East, which includes Israel-Palestinian question.
And yet the status quo led us to 9/11, and that hardly sounds good either. Habu, thanks for your call. Imad's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Imad. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I would like to disagree with the gentleman who described Saudi Arabia as Islamic as it can be, simply because in their, bylaws and constitution, stuff like that, the purpose of the state is to propagate Islam. There's a difference between what you say and actually what you actually do. There are so many practices in Saudi Arabia that contradict Islamic, principles. And
Imad, are you saying in that you would like to see a more strict Islam in Saudi Arabia?
No. I would like to see more properly understood Islam. I live in America. I came from Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
I think part or a major part of the frustration in that area with the whole situation is the oppressive governments, the lack of social justice, the lack of equal opportunity, the lack of freedom of speech. In Islam, there's no contradiction with that.
Which makes you see a kind of twisted Islam being represented here.
Exactly. People try to use Islam to suit their purposes. Same thing with the so-called terrorists. I'm not sure really what exactly the definition of terrorism. We're confused these days.
I guess blowing up people's homes almost at random has to constitute terrorism.
Absolutely. Anybody who hurts people at random is definitely a terrorist.
Yes, Imad.
However, I mean, in order to address the problem, you really have to understand the source and the origins of that problem. If somebody tells you your son, God forbid, is doing drugs, before you jump to lash out at him, he's a straight A student, he's been always good, suddenly he's doing drugs. You want to know why he's doing that. What suddenly happened that he started to do that?
So look more deeply. We've got the advice. The time is ticking down here, Maud, but thank you for your call. Thomas Lippman, what about it? Do you see a less violent, a less radical strain of Islam that our caller points to as the real Islam that could come to the fore here and provide an alternative? So it wasn't just, the West or Al-Qaeda.
Well, of course there are alternative strains of Islam. It is at once the great strength and the great weakness of Islam that no one is in charge of Islamic doctrine. Islam is a religion between an individual and God.
Well, fair enough, but Osama bin Laden has hijacked a fair bit of attention recently.
Yes, he has. He has hijacked a fair bit of attention, but Osama bin Laden is not acting in the name of Islam, whatever he says. Osama bin Laden is a fascist who's acting in the name of political power.
Well, easy to say, but he's wrapped himself in the religion very tightly.
Yeah, but so did Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein was a career secularist whose party was founded by a Christian. It's politically convenient to do that. And it's certainly true to say that many Islamic thinkers over the years have believed in a much more liberal approach to social and political interaction than you see from some of these people. That's entirely true.
10 years out, the House of Saud still in power or gone?
10 years?
Yeah.
Oh, in power. In power. I think that's not a difficult prediction. I don't think the threat to them is nearly as great now as it has been at other times in the past.
For all the violence. All right. Well, we've got a region in some flux, but Thomas Lippman, you see it sticking right there. Khaled Abu El-Fadl, I hope to have you back. We're out of time tonight. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Khaled Abu El-Fadl is law professor at Yale University, and Thomas Lippman, thanks very much to you for being with us. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, Al Gore lambastes the Bush administration over civil liberties. This is On Point. For the second time in 3 months, former Vice President Al Gore yesterday delivered a blistering critique of the administration of George W. Bush, the man who narrowly beat Gore to the White House in the 2000 presidential race. Speaking to 3,000 raucous supporters in Washington, Gore charged the administration with using fear of terrorism to undermine civil liberties. He called for a repeal of the Patriot Act and said the administration did irreparable harm by detaining innocent immigrants in the name of counterterrorism. Here's an excerpt from Gore's speech.
The disgraceful treatment suffered by many of these vulnerable immigrants at the hands of the administration has created deep resentments and hurt the cooperation desperately needed from the immigrant communities in the United States and from the security services of their countries of origin. And secondly, these gross violations of their rights have seriously damaged United States moral authority and goodwill around the world and delegitimized our efforts to continue promoting human rights. They call us hypocrites. So don't tell me you're protecting our national security by rounding up a bunch of people who have nothing to do with threatening our national security and abusing them. In fact, as one analyst put it, we used to set the standard in the world, and now we've lowered the bar. And after all, our moral authority in the United States of America is our greatest source of enduring strength in the world. And we ought to safeguard it, and we ought to care about it and respect it and not toss it away. And let me tell you, the handling of those prisoners at Guantanamo has been particularly harmful to America's image. Even England and Australia, you can't get better, stronger allies than that, have criticized our departure from international law and the Geneva Convention. Secretary Rumsfeld's handling of the captives there has been about as thoughtful as his post-war plan for Iraq. I don't think he thought either one of them through very well. And so the mass violations of civil liberties have hurt rather than helped. But there's yet another reason for urgency in stopping and reversing what this administration is doing where civil liberties are concerned. And it's this: they have already taken us farther down the road toward an intrusive Big Brother style government, toward the dangers prophesied by George Orwell in his book 1984, than anyone ever thought would have been possible in the United States of America. And they have done it primarily by heightening and exploiting public anxieties and apprehensions. Rather than leading with a call to courage, this administration has chosen to lead us by inciting fear over and over again. Almost 80 years ago, Justice Louis Brandeis wrote this: "Those who won our independence by revolution were not cowards. They did not exalt order at the cost of liberty. Those who won our independence," Brandeis asserted, "understood that courage is the secret of liberty and fear breeds only repression." We need a call to courage in America as part of our response to balancing civil liberties and national security. But rather than defending our freedoms, this administration has sought to abandon them. Rather than accepting our traditions of openness and accountability, this administration has opted to rule by secrecy and unquestioned authority. Instead, its assaults on our core democratic principles have only left us less free and less secure.
Former Vice President Al Gore speaking yesterday at the DAR Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.